Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I am Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording this show on Friday, February 19th, 2020. And so I have to ask, given that virtually the entire country is encased in ice at this point, what temperature is it out in LA right now, or...?
It's probably 74. I just had a lovely stroll with the dog, Jim. I'm in shorts right now, and so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. Not to rub it in your face, but yeah.
All right. Well, February in New England, you're telling yourself winter's almost over, and, you know, and winter's
false.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. There we go. February is just one sort of continuous kick to the groin. Before we get started here, when we were finishing up our last show, you were headed out the door to go to that Beauty and the Beast drive-in.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, that was really, really great. It was this tiny little sort of setup in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. There were only 15 cars there. Jordan, now I'm blanking on his name, the kid that's in all the holiday specials, mm-hmm. the kid who dances and sings, do you know who I'm talking about,
yep.
Jim?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was there, so I saw, he, you know, great to see him mm-hmm. out and about. But yeah, I mean, the Beauty and the Beast still totally rules, mm-hmm. so... It was delightful.
And just the film or no shorts or anything?
Just the film and, what was it, Mr. Duck Steps Out?
Oh, cool.
Which I think is a good, that's a good Valentine's Day double feature.
No, that works. It definitely works.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, following up on other news from last week, did you catch the piece over at Cartoon Brew? I want to say Chris Mulandry. The guy who helped get Blue Sky up out of the ground was looking back fondly at Blue Sky and sort of mourning its loss.
That was Deadline. I did not read it completely, but I was fascinated by it. I just haven't gotten a chance to.
Okay,
to
no, you're right.
Circle back. How was it?
It was a great piece, but again, I have to say, I'm still not past this yet. In fact, there's still a part of me that the whole Nimona thing, you know, that they were this close to a finished film. And Patrick Osborne, the guy who brought us Feast at Disney, that Academy Award-winning short, you know, was going to go to strut his stuff with a feature, and now we don't get that. And we did get news this week that for the first time in, 5 years, we're going to get a brand new short out of Disney.
Theatrical short.
Theatrical short.
We've had the short circuit program.
This is true. This is true for Disney Plus, but you're right.
And a lot of Olaf and Frozen material.
Also
which
true.
Hello, Ava. We got to say, give our shout out to her.
There we go.
But yeah, it's the first theatrical short. Mm. Did you see the poster? Because I think I know what the story is just based on the poster. I know you love spoiling things for yourself based on images.
Yes.
Or getting the art of book ahead of time or whatever.
So this one is Us Again, right? That's the title. And
yep.
Written and directed by the head of story on Big Hero 6, Zach Parrish.
Yep.
So the log line, basically, it's an elderly African-American couple go out for a night and... They relive their youth, right? That's through dance?
Well, they look like they're actually transformed into the younger versions of themselves, which reminds me of the very terrible Steven Spielberg section of the Twilight Zone movie. But what I've heard is that this one will leave you totally sobbing.
Okay, well.
So you will see it in the theatrical presentation of Raya and the Last Dragon starting on March 5th. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a theater that is open near you, which I don't know where theaters are open. Mm. I think there's a couple near you, Jim. But if you don't go see it theatrically, it'll be on Disney Plus in June.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
By the way, Drew is not wrong. The kick the can segment in the middle of the Twilight Zone movie, among the worst things Steven Spielberg has ever done in his life.
Yes.
It's just...
Well, you know, the story behind that is that he was going to do a scary short. Mm. And then the, you know, catastrophic accident happened.
That's right.
And so he said, I need to kind of sugar this up a little bit. Okay. And sugar it he did,
yeah,
Jim.
I mean, yeah, you can get diabetes. In fact, that's where I got it, I bet.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, well, burying the needle in the completely anti-diabetes direction, what about the Cruella trailer? What did you think about that?
I was very into the Cruella trailer. What did you think?
It's a lot of bold choices.
Yeah.
What was interesting for me was to watch sort of the social media reaction, and it's like, oh, great, this is Disney going for Joker. And it's like,
oh, I hated that. I thought that was so stupid
easy.
The only thing it shares with Joker is a loose time period, because this one is also set in the late 70s, early 80s, and the fact that it's an origin story. But I love the look of it. I think Craig Gillespie is awesome. He directed three really interesting movies for Disney, the Fright Night remake, which was part of their deal with DreamWorks, as well as Million Dollar Arm and The Finest Hours. Oh, so he has a really interesting pedigree with the company, and he always shoots things really well. And he was the director of the Oscar-nominated I, Tonya, which is great. And I just can't wait. I hear the soundtrack is very cool. And obviously, I think Emma Stone is going to just kill it. But I was very into it.
It's interesting you mentioned the Finest Hours, which happened here in New England. It was also shot in the Boston area. Probably not the best film to watch in February, especially given how many people are encased in ice and this sort of thing. But that's a genuinely great movie.
Yeah, it is.
Just did not connect with an audience when it came out. It's at moments like that that you kind of understand Disney pivoting into subscription streaming services, because at least then you're kind of guaranteed an audience. We're convincing people. Also, their Finest Hour, not the greatest title.
No. It was also like one of the last big 3D movies, which was cool if you saw it in 3D. It was just very dynamic.
Interesting and, point. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But anyway, I suggest you seek out all of his films. He's a very interesting... He also directs those annoying emu commercials for Liberty Mutual. The Limu Emu, those are him. Oh, so he...
You had me on board until you brought that up. Oh, jeez.
Sorry, I know that emu scares you.
I have issues. Well, as long as we're talking about subscription streaming services and the like... What do you make of the Skydance Animation news? With Luck and Spellbound now officially headed Apple, more to the point, they signed a huge deal with Apple TV, didn't they?
Yeah, there's an animated series coming as well, which is based on a children's book, and it makes sense because as I've joked here and on Light the Fuse repeatedly, Paramount just hates releasing movies. So why would they actually follow through and release these two animated movies? But yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because we're seeing kind of the Steve Jobs, John Lasseter relationship replicated in a way, just the kind of Apple crossover with him. Those two images, I couldn't tell if they were from the same movie or two different movies.
Well, I guess we should mention the other news in relation to at least Luck. We now have Jane Fonda joining the cast as a Luck Dragon?
Yeah, she like runs the Luck organization or something. There was a lot of confusion because people thought that she was replacing Emma Thompson, who left when she learned that Lasseter was coming over. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure she had a great experience with him on Brave. But... yeah, I don't know what, but then they're saying it's not the Emma Thompson character. So I don't know what is going on, but Luck follows around the unluckiest girl in the world who joins forces with magical creatures to uncover a force more powerful than Luck itself. So make of that what you will. Discuss amongst yourselves.
Okay.
I don't know. How do you feel about it?
Forgive me for making a weird pivot here, but we're talking about Mr. Lasseter. And this weekend on HBO, we have that 4-part documentary series, Allen versus Pharaoh, debuting, which I guess it's produced with cooperation of, you know, Mia Farrow and her children. And it's supposedly very, very, very one-sided. But on the other hand, it really sort of lays open all of the stuff that was laid at Woody Allen's feet. It's supposedly pretty devastating.
Yeah.
If we look at the books that have been written already about Harvey Weinstein and this documentary series about Woody Allen, what do you think the chances are when Luck or Spellbound finally shows up on Apple TV that we're not going to see a similar set of stories about John Lasseter? I mean, first when he stepped away from Disney and when they formally separated, there were a few stories in the trades. I want to say The Hollywood Reporter had a pretty large piece, but A lot of people were reluctant at that point to come forward and be quoted directly or that sort of thing. But with 2 and 3 years now since, do you think we're going to get the same sort of thing that we just were getting with Allen and with Weinstein with Lasseter?
I don't know. I wonder if Disney would try to put the kibosh on that. I'm still getting over the Michael Jackson documentary from a couple of years ago, Finding Neverland, which was so rough. But yeah, I mean, I'm still a little confused as to sort of what went on with Lasseter and what happened there. So I would love more clarification.
I would too, but at the same time, I just find myself at sixes and sevens. I mean, I genuinely respect what the man did, moving the CG in a direction that, you know, we're, if you think about all the films today that are made this way and storytelling and that sort of thing, but, but at the same time, as a man whose daughter is trying to get into animation in that field, and the fact that there's one less guy who's groping girls at parties, it's like, okay, this is a good thing, but it just sort of like...
Right.
If this comes out, and again, it's something like this Allen documentary or the Weinstein book here now, I feel worse for Nancy Lasseter and the kids than I do for John.
Well, I hope you... what makes them feel better is their... never-ending stream of money, Jim. I think that you should not feel bad. I mean, I would hate for people to have to relive that period as well, which you would have to do, obviously, in a documentary like this. But yeah, it would be interesting to figure out what went down and how long it went on and how many other people that revelation could bring down in terms of when it was... when it was first noticed, who did nothing about it? You know, is this something that Iger knew about when he bought the company? I would really love to know that kind of stuff.
True.
So,
in other Pixar-related news, did you see the photos today coming out of Hong Kong where they've debuted the brand new Woody walk-around character?
Yeah, he looks great.
He does. But it's so funny because for years when they were working on the Toy Story characters, it was always about Buzz because the people who had to wear the Buzz outfit were winding up getting crippled by just the sheer weight of it, or, you know, the fact that...
with the backpack and everything?
Oh, yeah. That you know, I guess the first version of it was 70 pounds, just the upper body piece. And, you know, the poor guys had come off stage and it just sort of like, I can't do this anymore. I'm screwing up my back. So... but it's nice to see Woody's getting a little love there.
Well, you're always good about spotting new walk-around characters. I remember you and I were at some press event, and you leaned over to me and you said, that's the new Asian Mickey. Because it was the Mickey from, I don't know if it was a Hong Kong or Shanghai.
It's Shanghai, yes.
Okay. He has sort of a more rounded face. He's a little bit more expressive. Generally cuter, I would say.
Well, no, that's it exactly. Mickey. Buy more plush.
Right.
And speaking of shows that I guess people are hoping start pushing sales of plush, what do you make of this Gremlins prequel that they've already decided to renew for a second season?
Well, what I think that whenever these animated shows are quote unquote renewed for a second season, I think that they just build more episodes into the initial production schedule, because you and I both know what hell it is to bring a animated show to life. Yeah. I mean, the production schedules are just crazy, and they're, especially if they're 11-minute episodes. I'm not sure what Gremlins is, but the amount of overlap in between episodes is just really, really staggering. So I think they just ordered more episodes in that initial batch. So, did you see the casting? It's like got this amazing cast.
Absolutely. Is it now a new rule in Hollywood that you've got a show based on a hit franchise and Ming-Na Wen must be signed?
She's unstoppable.
Yeah,
she's unstoppable.
Well, no, I don't get me wrong. I love her work, but it's like every time I turn around, oh, of course, there you are.
Yes. And joining her is her Mulan co-star, yes, Bidi Wong.
Yes.
And James Hong, who was also in James Hong is a legend, first of all. I'm just happy that guy's still working. Yeah. And Matthew Reese from The Americans and Perry Mason. You know who we haven't seen on this list, though, Jim? Mm-hmm. Howie Mandel.
The young lady who is actually now voicing Gizmo, you know, proudly announced it on Twitter. But yeah, Howie's not back. Well, I guess America's Got Talent is keeping him very busy.
Yeah, right. You don't think he can go into a booth for 30 minutes a day and go, I can do it. I can do it, Jim.
Well, okay.
Put me in, coach.
If it doesn't pan out for the young woman on Twitter, we now have a fallback.
Yes, yes.
That show's going to debut on HBO Max. And while we're talking about animation things for subscription streaming services, so, well, again, this isn't animated, the Addams Family. This is a live action. In fact, it's Wednesday. Is that the title?
That's the name, yeah. It sort of follows her in school when she's a little bit older. But I thought it was worth bringing up for a couple of reasons. One is that Tim Burton started almost in TV doing that bizarre kung fu version of Hansel and Gretel for Disney, which was aired one time on Halloween night.
yes.
Which was live action. But I also wanted to bring up the fact that he, at one point, was attached to an Addams Family stop motion movie for Illumination.
That's right. Yeah.
Many years ago. Mm-hmm. It looks like, 2010. Mm-hmm. So 11 years ago. So it was going to be a stop motion 3D movie.
Mm-hmm. So we're aging up Wednesday and following her in school.
It sounds a little Riverdale-ish. Yeah, she's in some school. I think it's called Nevermore Academy.
Okay.
And she is dealing with a local murder, monsters, supernatural things, and her family, obviously. But
did you ever get to see the Addams Family musical that played on Broadway a few years ago? It was they had Nathan Lane as Gomez and B.B. Newirth as Morticia.
No, I heard it was great, though.
That's kind of a matter of opinion. The fact is that there's kind of a famous story of Nathan Lane is backstage in his dressing room, and the great Broadway diva Elaine Stritch comes backstage after a performance and sort of walks into Nathan's dressing room, and he turns around to look at her, and she announces from the door, "Whatever they're paying you, it's not enough." Because evidently, he really had to work to sort of put that show over. I mean, it does have a couple of great numbers. If you head over to YouTube, there's a couple of them there.
It only ran for a year, like a little over a year, a year and a half, but for 722 performances in that time.
And again, as long as Lane was in the show, they sold out. It's one of the only shows that when they went to tour it, they actually went back in and rewrote a lot of the book and restaged a lot of the show before they then put the show out on tour. So that tells you a lot about what Nathan was doing to sort of put it over the top.
You're talking to someone whose last live theater experience was the touring company of Escape from Margaritaville, which I saw on February 28th, 2020, and left during the intermission. Oh. So, yeah. I'll never know if that volcano exploded, Jim. That's all I'll say.
Wow. All right. I know Jimmy will not be happy to hear about this.
That's all right. He's got some cheeseburgers in paradise, Jim.
All right. And as long as we're talking about unlikely show business things, what do you make of this animated merman comedy that Fox has got in the works?
It's very interesting how Fox is really doubling down on its animated programming. Mm-hmm. It sounds pretty interesting to me. Mm-hmm. It's coming from veterans of the Righteous Gemstones and I Think You Should Leave, and I don't know, it sounds pretty interesting. It's about a mermaid prince who juggles life between the ocean, the only home he's ever known, and his new life on land with his human mother in the breathtaking metropolis of Tampa, Florida.
Oh no.
So
oh,
that sounds pretty funny.
That does. Yeah. Okay. All right. Suddenly I'm on board.
Yeah.
Right up until Tampa, Florida, I was hesitant, but oh, Tampa.
Yes.
Okay. Now.
Yes.
So we have that coming. And just this week, we got news that we've got kind of on the heels of last year's pandemic special from South Park, which I was just starting. Did you see the ratings for this thing? It was their...
No.
All right. Their pandemic special, which ran back in September 30 of last year, was the highest rated episode for the show in 7 years, with 4.4 million people tuning in that night. Did you actually get to see this where they revealed?
No. I've sort of been off the South Park train for the last few years. So
okay, well, I did.
You'll just have to recap it.
You know their take on Mickey Mouse, sort of the brutal corporate keeping everybody in line? Mickey and Stan's dad have a hand in how things got started in Wuhan. And because this is a family show, I can't get into details, but it involves unnatural relations with a bat. And it always amazes me when I watch South Park in action like this and what they do with the Disney characters. It's like, where is Disney legal? How do they actually get away with this? Is that parody? Is that what the blanket protection there? Or
I guess so. Yeah.
Oh,
I guess so.
So on the heels of the huge rating success of that one, again, that was a special hour-long episode. Oh, we have another hour-long episode called the South Park Vaccination Special, which will air on March 10th. And if the pandemic special is any indication, I would imagine Bob Chapek is going to be sitting somewhere with a bottle of Jim or a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. I think that's the only way he's going to ride this thing out. And while, you know, we're talking about people who are going to think animation that's going to upset people, later in March, just 5 days after the South Park vaccination episode airs, we're going to get our final DuckTales, which, again, they've made it kind of an interesting choice to go out really with a bang. That I guess the final three episodes they've decided to air as one 90-minute long special. Have I got that right?
Yeah, they did the same thing, I think, with the Gravity Falls finale when that was all done. Do you remember the battle for Weird Mageddon or whatever?
Yeah,
so taking a page out of that book.
Yeah. So 90 minutes long, airs on March 15th, beginning at 7 p.m. And I don't know if you've seen what, like, Matt Youngberg or Francisco Aguinal has been. They've been tweeting out. It's kind of interesting. These guys still seem to be sort of angling for the show to be revived or saved or something. I mean, it's just sort of, you know, suggesting, you know, it's right there. It could be picked up for a fourth season.
Yeah, that doesn't seem likely.
No, it doesn't. So,
I mean, they've got an amazing guest cast. It sounds like everybody's sort of coming back for the last batch. But did you see that Adam Pally is also a voice? He's from Happy Endings.
Yeah.
I think he's Baloo is my guess. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
That I want to
see. You know, people hate it when I drop DuckTales news, Jim, so I'll just, you know, just leave that there.
Okay. So still making friends. All right. Just to remind folks, this final set of episodes begins airing on February 22nd. And I guess we'll get a new one every Monday right up until the, you know, the Big Bang finale.
I thought there were 9 left, but it only is 6, really, if we're counting the last one as 3.
Yeah, I think that's how they've chose to burn them off. But that brings us up to date. And, you know, when we get back from a quick commercial break here, Drew and I will share an interview that we did with Tim Story, the director of the new Tom and Jerry movie.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Before we get started, we should let people know that the Tom and Jerry film debuts this coming Friday, February 26th.
Yeah, it'll be this Friday when people listen to this, for sure. Okay. February 26th.
Okay. And you and I got the chance to see the film out ahead of talking with Tim. This month is the 81st anniversary of the first Tom and Jerry film, Puss Gets the Boot, being released to theaters. MGM put it out on February 10th, 1940. And it fascinates me that these really, really, really violent cartoons. In fact, they were what they really considered the springboard for Itchy and Scratchy on The Simpsons.
Yeah. And the movie, let me tell you, is really violent too. So you will get everything.
But violent in a cartoon slapstick kind of way? We want to stress that. Do you want to run down the cast or?
Yeah, sure. Chloe Grace Moretz is the lead. We've got Michael Peña in there from Ant-Man, Colin Jost, Rob Delaney, Kim Jong.
Just do a little bit more history on Tom and Jerry. What's fascinating to me is, again, these ridiculously violent cartoons were also hugely popular. In fact, from the late 40s into the 50s, they won 7 Academy Awards for Best Animated Short.
Oh, I had no idea, actually.
Yeah, they actually Disney's Silly Symphony series had been the record holder up until that point. And Tom and Jerry, just as, you know, sort of theatrical cartoons died, they nailed the 7th one. So it's literally Tom and Jerry and Silly Symphonies are the most winning animation series. And then there was this weird period where Chuck Jones animated a bunch of the, you know, took over the characters at MGM. They're weird cartoons. They are, it's, you know, if you know Chuck Jones's comic sensibility from the Roadrunner cartoons or you know, Duck Amuck or that sort of thing, it's that, but it's the characters are also drawn with extremely cute eyes, and it's this weird sense of humor along with a cloying cartoon design. And then, honestly, the weirdest moment is in 1965, MGM sells the Tom and Jerry cartoons to CBS, and they start running them on Saturday morning. But what happens is CBS is going through the catalog. They're looking at, like, wow, these are really violent. And they're also kind of racist. There was a character, Mammy Two Shoes, that you only saw from the knees down.
Yeah, I think we talked about her on a previous episode.
We did. And what's kind of interesting is that one of the last things that Chuck Jones did with Tom and Jerry is his company reanimated all of the scenes involving Mammy Two Shoes. They erased all of her dialogue. They brought June Foray in to record new dialogue, and they repainted all of the black housekeeper from the knees down to a white Irish housekeeper. So it's June Foray doing her sort of Marjorie Main impression. This is where a lot of kids of my generation and going forward, this is where they first got to see Tom and Jerry, was this Saturday morning thing. And now Tim, on the other hand, he wasn't born till 1970. He's a real Tom and Jerry fan. He really studied the shorts. Let's let him talk about how he made this film happen. And again, we'll start off now with Drew and Tim talking.
Hello. How are you?
Hey there. What's up, Drew?
How are you? It's so exciting to chat with you about this. I was wondering what did you look at in terms of the animation, live action, hybrid. Obviously, I think Roger Rabbit is sort of like the Citizen Kane of that, right? But did you look at other things when approaching this?
Yeah, I must admit, not really. I kind of went back to Roger Rabbit. Then I went to the original Tom and Jerry cartoon, you know, shorts.
Okay.
And, you know, look, I did, you know, check out, you know, the original Mary Poppins, you know. But I kind of stuck to that. I kind of knew. And I had seen, you know, we've seen many, many before. Like I'm familiar with the other films that have taken the characters and made them CGI characters inside of the real world. So I had seen so many of those, but those weren't the ones that I were going to use for the base of what we were creating here. So after watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I must admit, I went into my own little cocoon and figured out that, okay, we're going to now create these characters with real actors, obviously human actors, quote unquote. And I just kind of knew or felt I knew what this film should be, how it should move and how it should, you know, and it was trying to figure out kind of a tone because we were dealing with two separate worlds. You had an animated world that had certain rules. And then, of course, we as humans have our own rules. And I just wanted to be sure that those merged seamlessly and hopefully people would like it.
Right. Well, can you talk about the look of the characters? Because it's an interesting kind of 2D, 3D-ish look that maintains a lot of the integrity of the original characters, but kind of updates them. How did you kind of land on this? Was there a lot of exploration?
There was some exploration in the beginning of figuring out how, for lack of a better word, how thick do you make the 2D? We always called it 2D plus because we were never going to go with characters that were completely, say, round, you know, in the event you turned them around, you weren't supposed to see the full volume of them. But we also knew that one thing that we were going to push was the environments they were in. So we knew that we were going to take lighting and have a lot of fun with lighting because we thought that that would kind of give this a fuller look, a more complex look. And so at times, like when Tom is in the rain or when they're in the animal shelter, which is kind of like our jail cell, we knew we were going to have, you know, moody lighting. So we knew that that light might have to wrap around them slightly. So I must admit, we went from shot to shot and figured out how much or how little we could do. We found that in wider shots, we could have more of the thickness of the character. But we knew, but we also found that in being close up to them, we would have less. So we just kind of, it was actually a shot by shot base. And that always told us where we should go once we saw it.
Well, it's interesting too, because in the rain, it's like the rain is sort of running down him, like, you know, on a piece of glass or something. It's not like super detailed. Was that effects animation also sort of taking that same approach?
Yeah, Fraser Churchill, who was my visual effects supervisor, he had a lot of ideas on how to you know, show this, and we saw many early tests. And sometimes we would pull back on how real the, you know, specifically the sweat, you know, there's some sweat that happens with him. But we also had to remember, well, the sweat was coming from Tom. So we took a liberty to make that water or sweat more cartoonish, as you might say. But when he was in the rain was not coming from him. So it was, we just had a lot of fun in talking. We had like ridiculous conversations about the rules of this film, which were actually quite fun because you would get in arguments about the thickness of water and, you know, but we had some fun with it, you know, with the saliva from Spike, you know, we just had a lot of fun with what, you know, how real or how fake we wanted this to look.
Was there ever any sort of pressure to give them voices? I imagine at some point some executive said, Kevin Hart for Tom. I mean,
sure. There were conversations about it, but I was adamant to not go outside the rules that Hanna-Barbera had set up in their original shorts, you know. In their shorts, Tom and Jerry just did not talk, you know. Every now and then Tom would break the fourth wall and say something, or he would sing, and so we did that with ours, or they would both scream. But there were certain rules that those original 100 or so shorts set up, and I was adamant to make sure that we never broke those rules, because for some reason other animals talked and Hanna-Barbera made it a point for these two characters not to talk. So I wanted to honor that.
What was the hardest shot to pull off? I mean, there are some pretty complex things outside and, you know, in natural environments. And what was the hardest sort of shot to pull off?
Oh, gosh, good question. Really the New York chase. We just knew that, you know, there was no way in the world we were going to be able to shoot much in New York, especially not a chase.
Right.
So it was kind of create, you know, a weird merging of like from a CGI truck to real truck footage to them being on the streets and getting digital photography that we would later make move, and some footage of the cement ground, you know, creating CGI skateboards. So there was a lot of that was a kind of us constantly going back and forth on how to bring this chase to fruition and it was difficult, but luckily I think we all turned away with something that was that we were really proud of.
Well, I mean, you've worked with visual effects throughout your career, and obviously on the Fantastic Four movies, which, you know, were so long ago. How have visual effects changed since then, and how has your sort of approach to working with visual effects changed?
Oh, they've changed so much. I mean, everything is much faster. I mean, on the original Fan 4 film, this is going to date me. On the original Fan 4 film, we actually were looking at, once we did an effect, we had to look at it on film, you know, I remember with that film, we did shoot the special effects and digital cameras, but we were using film to do that original movie. So it's really crazy how much it's come, you know, in terms of what we can capture, what we can pull off in-house, what we can pull off, you know, what we have to send out. So it's come so far, and that's why to make movies in this realm, you know, right now, up today, your imagination has no limitations. And so with this film, what was fun about this is we could really go into a room and go, well, what do we want them to do? You know, as opposed to, can we do that? It's always, you just kind of think about what you want to do and go for it. And the visual effects artists, they're just so brilliant, they can pull it off.
Tim, I love how you reached back to get the stuff from the actual cartoons from the 40s. Like, for example, the Animal Tornado. Can you talk a little bit about how you managed to get Michael in there?
Yeah. Well, what was fun about this is Michael is such a physical actor in the sense that everything from him being pulled by Spike, when he's on the street being pulled by Spike, we actually at times just gave him a little leash thing about that big, and he would do all the sliding and all of that stuff like that. So when it came to the Animal Tornado and getting him inside of it, you wouldn't believe how ridiculous it looked when we were shooting it, which was we had blue screen all around him and pads, and he would just throw himself around and say the words. And that's Michael. Like, he would stuff that we, sometimes we had rigs prepared and Michael would just go, well, don't you just want me to do this and yell that at this point? Well, I'll just do it, you know? And you just kind of, you know, there's a moment, I don't know if you catch it, where he's from the bar, he's pulled and he goes down and then he jumps back up, you know? And that's all Michael Pena. So we had a lot of fun coming up with the ideas and then figure out whether Michael actually needed help pulling it off.
By the way, New York has never looked better than it looks in this film.
Oh, thank you.
You know, you did a great, great job. First of all, obviously, you shot this pre-COVID. When did you get your stuff in Central Park?
Well, what was interesting is we got the stuff in Central Park actually at some point before COVID, I think. Because we actually did also get a few more things post, you know, when COVID was actually happening. Stuff like when the pigeon falls down on the ground and there's a person on a bicycle that rides by. There's a few things that we actually went out there and believe it or not, we had to actually remove masks. You know, we had to actually go in digitally remove masks from some of the people walking and talking. But that particular park shot, I think we actually were able to get, as I like to say, BC before COVID. And then there were other things that we got, but we had, when Tom stops in front of Madison Square Garden, we had to erase a bunch of masks or either turn them flesh color so you didn't see them. So it's really interesting.
Wow. Well, can you talk about working with the actors and what that was like? I mean, there's a lot of great like line of sight and, you know, everybody seems very much in the same space. Did that sort of take a lot of, you know, rehearsals or what was that process like?
Well, interestingly enough, something that I had never worked with is puppets. We actually had a puppeteer on set to do Tom's stuff as well as a guy that was being actually acted like a dog, you know, knee pads and a padding on his hands and actually barked and ran around like Spike so that the actors actually had eye line as well as action, you know, so that there was always something being tugged, you know, if whether it was Colin or whether it was Michael who was holding Spike, they had something that moved their body when they would, you know, when they would tug. So we tried every method, you know, even to the point where with the puppet for Tom, since Tom didn't speak, it actually worked out perfect. And then some of the actors would sometime want to do the first couple of takes with the puppet because it gave them so much to work against. So we tried every, you know, method we could to make sure the actors had all the tools that they needed to give us a great performance.
Was it hard for some of them? I mean, did it take some coaxing?
You know, it took a little. Luckily, like Michael had done a lot of visual effects work, especially when right. he was in the Ant-Man movies. And then you had Chloe, and Chloe had a fun perspective on it. She said, I was a child actor. So many times the actors would leave her alone to do her side of it. So she said, I got really good at acting by myself. So when she said that, I went, oh my gosh, she's so brilliant in that. So we found many ways and they as well found many ways to make it not so difficult.
If you go back over the 81-year history of Tom and Jerry, it's cartoon slapstick violence. Nobody actually gets hurt. You know, they get hit in the face with a shovel and then their face is shaped like a shovel for a moment. But throughout the history of these characters, you know, they've walked them back and forth from really violent to, hey, they're just friends. And, you know, when you were getting started on this thing, you really do lean into some wonderful slapstick in this thing. There's some amazing action scenes, but what were the conversations like with the studio? I mean, how much was too much or that sort of thing?
Yeah. I have to give them complete credit. I asked them early on, are you guys in any way concerned about the amount of violence that I'm going to put in this movie? And they said, no. Wow. They said, make a Tom and Jerry cartoon. And that was the kind of freedom I got from day one. And I said, okay, you know, even to the point where I was in London and we were having some of the animators do certain things. And I say, guys, it's got to be violent. When he hits such and such, or when he, it's got to hurt. And we pushed the envelope. And I don't think we ever went completely over the line, but we always pushed it. Because when I went back and studied the old, you know, it's weird how much you know in your head, but then you go back and study it. I was amazed at how violent those cartoons were. And even to the point where when we started researching some of the sound effects, they actually use gunshots as some of the impact sounds. So we found that sometimes we would take that and, you know, pull it back a little bit and put like a weird sound over it, or a sound that sounds a little less harsh, you know. So we actually did most of our pullback in the sound design of this movie. But the actual action, look, at some point, Tom pulls out a freaking chainsaw. You know, we never held back to what the violence was going to be here. And thankfully, Warner Brothers allowed us to go for it.
Was anybody ever nervous when they saw the final version? Were they like,
no, okay, absolutely not. You know, it was that was incredible about this experience. They allowed us to do it, and we found that even the kids, as we were able to do some tests, not a lot of tests, but as we were able to do some tests, we found that no parents, you know, the parents actually applauded the way we approached the violence, that we always made it, you know, as fun as it can be. You know, that is like a fingers crossed, because we all always knew that if the parents started boycotting us in terms of violence, that we'd have to change it. And luckily we didn't have to.
I mean, going back over those old cartoons, did you figure out what made these characters so enduring and sort of tried to apply it to this movie?
I always just came back to, I have a twin sister, and I've made it my, you know, my life's work to get on her nerves. And I just kind of, you know, went back to, they, for some reason, you know, I think all of us, whether it's a fight with a sibling or it's a fight with a really, really close friend, there's a love there. And when you can, you know, have unapologetic fights and create havoc in somebody's world, whether it's really trying to teach them a lesson or whether it's just trying to make them laugh. This kind of stuff is fun. And I think as a kid, the other side of it is, when do you get to destroy a house and not get kicked out of the house? You know, Tom and Jerry always did that. And I wanted to make it a point to do that in this film. And I think as I look back, there is just something about family, friends fighting and giving each other crap and making their world a complete hell, that there's a lot of enjoyment that we get out of that as a child.
What's kind of intriguing about this story is that in the end, there really isn't a villain. I mean, what I kind of enjoyed about this story is that everybody gets redeemed, even Michael's character, who clearly sets, you know, the whole wedding laid waste to in motion. That a deliberate choice early on, or did that develop with the script?
Well, I think it kind of developed inside of shooting the movie. You know, once you brought Michael Pena into this role, there is this thing, there's just this lovable quality about what who he is and what he created with Terrence. And as I've always done, and I think any villain, what makes a villain really great is that when you finally take a look at their side of it, they're not wrong, you know, like, or their plan was well thought out, or whatever you want to call it. You kind of understand their belief system. And that's what happened with Michael. And I think as we wrote this, as we shot them, that idea at the end of the character of I forget her, Perry Bottom. I forget my character's name. But as she comes back and there's that little, you know, moment of you knowing that Michael's gonna be he kind of quote unquote became a good guy. That came up in the shooting of the movie, and we said, you know what? Why not bring back? Not only did that give Kayla, the character played by Chloe Grace Moretz, you liked her again because she righted her wrong, but also it gave Michael kind of like a little pat on the back for figuring out what the true meaning of things are. And we just found that at the end of this movie, we wanted people to really smile. And although you can also smile when the villain gets his comeuppance, he never did anything that terrible. And in the sense of Kayla, she was the one that lied first, you know? So we just wanted to be sure that the family at the end of this, meaning the actors, the characters, everybody kind of found some good ending.
If you could tackle another Hanna-Barbera character or, you know, series or something, who would it be?
Secret Squirrel. Give me Secret Squirrel, Adamant, you know? Give me those guys, you know.
I love it.
I'd love to see who you'd get for Morocco Mole.
Now we're talking about now you're with me.
Okay. Thank you so much for chatting, Tim. This was a big thrill.
Right, okay. Thanks, guys.
This is a great looking film. Given that we've all been trapped in our houses and we haven't been able to go to New York, that Tim made New York look this good. But I love that story he was telling about when they had to go back in and do the follow-up shots outside of Madison Square Garden and digitally remove the masks.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And the same people that did the animation for Tom and Jerry, Framestore, mm-hmm. also did the animation for Flora and Ulysses, which is on Disney Plus this weekend.
That's right.
Which is actually really cute, a really cute movie. Mm-hmm. But they are very versatile, and they really leaned into the kind of cartooniness in this one, and really, really cool.
Check it out, folks. So again, drops in theaters February 26th, but also on HBO Max. Okay, so I guess that's going to do it for this week's show, but Drew and I will be back with a brand new episode of Fine Tuning shortly. But until then, there are some other great podcasts that you should check out, and among them are Light the Fuse and Light the Wick. So what is going on with Light the Fuse, Light the Wick? And
we're deep in Light the Wick territory, Jim. We're doing that for the next few months. And I think we are coming back. I think our 150th show is on the same week as May the 4th. So that's when we're going to bring out our Paul Hirsch interview.
Cannot wait.
And we're also going to bring out a brand new logo designed by the geniuses at Filmograph, who are responsible for the title sequences of Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, and Mission Impossible Fallout.
Wow.
So, ooh. Sort of a cool little extra bit.
That is killer. Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah.
All right. Cannot wait. Are we going to do merch with this, or...?
Yes, we're going to do merch. We're going to do everything. Yeah.
Oh, so. killer. All right.
Yeah.
Well, definitely, folks, you're missing out on truly great stories if you're not listening to Light the Fuse and Light the Wick. And don't get me wrong, we have some nice stories over at the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. Len and I are plugging away at Disney Dish. Oh, God, the Joseph Mankiewicz archive. We've got a show coming up shortly where Len and Aaron actually hired professional voice actors.
I can't wait to listen to this, Jim. I got a little sneak preview in my
mailbox.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll tell you what I think.
Okay. But it's the original. Well, to be fair, it's probably the second draft of the script for American Adventure, because the script notes say revised first edition. So evidently there was a rewrite, and trust me, there were a lot of rewrites that came after this. But yeah, that they do this amazing job of giving you what the Imagineers first thought they'd do with the American Adventure. And it's an interesting bend on the story. And speaking of Aaron Adams, he's the gentleman I do the Marvelous Disney podcast with, and we'll be recording a new episode of that shortly. we got another Universal Giant. We got a Dustin Fuse and I need to get in the bag for next week. Whole pile of stuff headed your way. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Jim Hill Media and on Facebook at Jim Hill Media News. That'll do it for this week, and Drew and I will be back next week with more animation news.